The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. It's Oliver Callan here, who is in for Ryan all this week. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in the one place. And so this week, Jim Deegan of Rail Tours Ireland told me about his efforts to reopen a stretch of heritage railway and herald the return of the steam train to Connemara. Limerick model, blogger and social media influencer Louise Cooney spoke to me about leaving New York and moving home after COVID-19 hit and how exploring Ireland opened her eyes to the best of what our little country has to offer. Irish hockey star Nikki Daly talked to us about the delay of Tokyo 2020, putting her Olympic dream on hold and how she's getting back into the family business of motorsport. Co-author of the Aisling series, Emer McLysett, spoke to us about being a lifelong fan of the literary legend Maeve Binchy as Circle of Friends turns 30 this year. And 3 decades on, Roddy Doyle talked to me about the profound impact Italian 90 had on the country and the joy Big Jack brought to our nation when we needed it most. So that's it. Thanks for listening and I hope you enjoy it. Now let's go to the phone lines. We're going to speak to Jim Deegan. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Oliver.
We'd mentioned earlier on, you're the chief executive of Rail Tours Ireland and you're bringing the steam engine back to Clifton.
Well, yes, I'm a railway enthusiast and since childhood I've always wanted to restore a bit of the old Galway to Clifton line, which ran through the most magnificent scenery of Connemara.
I can imagine.
And we formed a not-for-profit company and acquired the old Mam Cross station and a stretch of the old track bed. And we're putting back a bit of the track and we're going to run a train, hopefully this year, early October, to mark the 125th anniversary of the closure of the line. And then, of the opening of the line,
and
it closed then in 1935.
And, I mean, so that's quite soon, isn't it? I mean, what's there right now? Are you actively building tracks?
Well, what we're doing is the line was originally 5'3", which was the Irish standard gauge, but we're building a pop-up railway, 3-foot gauge, just because we can do it quite quickly, and we'll be able to run a steam train this year, along with a little mini steam rally, the first time it's ever happened in Connemara.
Wow. And is that a new... Where did the steam rally come from?
Well, the steam rally is... These are held usually around the Midlands every year, but we've never had one in the West. And it'll have a couple of three or four steam traction engines. But we're hoping to have a steam locomotive for the railway along with some vintage carriages.
Brilliant.
So it'll really look fantastic.
And how long will how long will that stretch be?
Well, it'll be about half a mile.
Half a mile, yeah. So you get the full experience, though.
Oh, you'll get the full experience.
Because it's all about the noise, isn't it, and the steam and the
It's all about the whistling, the flag waving, the cheers, and the chuffing of the engine. And of course, it runs through the most magnificent scenery.
Yeah, and it has real windows that come down. You know, nowadays you can't open any of the
windows,
so you can wave a little handkerchief out the window.
Yes.
Farewell, like, Connemara.
Yes, that's right. Leather straps holding the windows in place. it's going to be very exciting and we're hoping to do it at the first weekend of October. COVID permitting, of course.
So you need the staycationers, obviously, to help you out because it would have been a huge thing for overseas visitors. But at least, you know, this is the start of something that could last a long time and extend.
Well, this will be permanent. Once we have the pop-up railway, once we run this event, we'll take up the pop-up railway and then put down the permanent way. And it will be a heritage railway. There's only one other in Ireland, in Downpatrick, of the same gauge, 5'3", the Irish standard gauge. But there are hundreds in Britain. So this is something that's been done for years.
It's amazing we don't have it here up to now.
And we really haven't got it now.
What's your dream? How far do you think you're going to be able to bring those railway tracks, and how long do you think you can bring a steam engine?
Well, at the moment we have Mam Cross station, which is 8.5 acres and about half a kilometre of track, but we're in the middle of 5 miles or 8 kilometres of uninterrupted track bed.
Wow.
And now there's a greenway coming, but you know, we can live with the greenway and they can live with us. So
how would that work? Because usually the greenway goes right on across. I know the Monaghan Way has used old railway tracks and you literally just walk.
Well, when they, the land take was very, when they were building the railway across the bog, effectively, the land take was very big, very wide. So there's actually plenty of room for a greenway and the railway, the heritage railway.
That could be very nice. So you could cycle and walk alongside an engine chugging along.
Yes, echoing to the mountains of Connemara and running by the several lakes along the way. So the scenery is just stunning.
Of course. Are you from around there, Jim? Or how did you?
Well, my grandmother was a Joyce from nearby the Man Valley, Joyce country, near Linan. And I've been going down there since I've been a kid and looking out the car window at the disused railway line beside me and always thinking, man, I'd love to put a bit of that back.
And now it's really happening.
Well, please God.
Yeah. And if you want to go into...
It's a not-for-profit company, and all the volunteers were there nearly every Saturday if anyone wants to come and see us. But it's all
where's
volunteered.
That? In Mamscroft. Mamscroft, yeah. And when you say it's non-profit, but you're not getting any support from the government for this, are you?
We've had no aid from any state agency so far.
But you haven't looked for it?
Well, that's another story.
Okay. That's another. That's for the next programme.
<That's right. laughs>
Come here, if you wanted to do a staycation, is there a railway holiday you can do staycation-wise in this country now?
Oh, yes. Well, I run a company called Rail Tours Ireland, and we've just launched the Emerald Pullman, a private train that is going to leave Dublin every Sunday for 3 weeks in August, August the 9th, 16th and 23rd, and it'll travel around Ireland. The staycation with the difference.
Right.
An all-Ireland tour, we'll be travelling to Waterford, Cork, Killarney, Galway.
Ennis and Belfast.
Belfast.
So can you sleep
Belfast
on the train or do you get out?
No, we don't sleep in the trains. We sleep in four-star hotels. But we can pick up people in Waterford. We can pick up people in Cork and Limerick.
It's a five-star experience with white-gloved waiters. That sounds expensive. How much now for 8 nights on that?
Well, 7 nights is 1,899 euro per person, Sherry.
Yeah.
And it's pretty good value. 7 nights, 4-star hotels. We're in the Great Southern in Killarney, the Hardiman in Galway, the Europa in Belfast, and the lovely Granville in Waterford.
Wow, I didn't know that existed. That's just launched. That's a new thing.
That's a brand new thing. It's on our website, railtoursireland.com.
That sounds really special.
You can go very unusually as part of this. You can go from Galway to Belfast. So that's a first.
I have to go. Listen, I could talk to you all day about trains. Thank you very much, Jim Deegan, Rail Tours Ireland. Good morning to you. We'll take a wee break.
Thanks
a million.
Thank you very much.
We're going to go to our lines now because Louise Cooney is one of the most popular influencers in the country and she's the go-to woman for all things fashion, beauty, travel and lifestyle. But she's just recently returned home from New York. Let's find out what's been happening. Louise, good morning.
Morning, Oliver. How are you?
Not so bad at all.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Not at all. We're delighted to talk to you. You only moved to New York, was it last September?
Yeah, only last September, yeah. And I moved back then at the end of March.
So you had high hopes of your fabulous New York life. You're having a fabulous lifestyle anyway, as people can tell. Hundreds of thousands of them on Instagram. But you came back in March. How has it felt? Is this your plans all out the window?
Yeah, it's been a crazy adjustment. You know, I've kind of just had to accept, you know, that we have no control. And yeah, it's been an up and down. And now I've just, you know, I had to make a call on what I was going to do about New York. I had, you know, had to pay rent for a year. I signed a lease for a year. I'd put a lot of money into, you know, buying furniture for the apartment. All the apartments over there come unfurnished, and I'd spent so much time building connections and getting set up, and just right when I was kind of getting on my feet, this happened. And now obviously everything's been turned upside down, and I've decided for the foreseeable anyway, I'm not going to go back. I'm going to get my stuff packed up and I'm going to come home and stay home for the time being. You know, obviously things aren't getting better really over there. So yeah, it's been a, you know, an adjustment, and it's been kind of like not what I planned and not what I dreamed for the year, but that's kind of life, isn't it? And you just have to roll with it.
I mean, it was leaving New York in March, it was getting very serious at that stage, wasn't it?
Yeah, like when I booked my flight, it was 2 weeks after quarantine kind of started. And within 4 days of me booking my flight before I took off, I think the numbers had doubled. You know, it was just getting so much worse every day. It was to the point where I was like, am I even going to be able to get on this flight home?
Yeah.
And then I think when I left, there were 30,000 cases, and it went up to, in the city, 100,000, you know. So that was crazy, you know, that like since I left, it went up to 100 and further, you know.
So was it a bit of a ghost town then for the last little while that you were in New York?
Yeah, it was, yeah, because people weren't going to work. I lived in Midtown, and the normal kind of work commuter is people going to restaurants and bars and out and about, that they weren't there. So the streets were dead. And even some of the streets, Park Avenue, had become pedestrianised, which was cool to see, but just crazy, you know.
Yeah, and did you wander around? Were you able to wander around the city, actually?
Yeah, you were, but you had to be conscious to kind of keep your distance, and it's hard because the city is actually quite small. So if you went to the parks, you would meet people, you know, and it was actually quite difficult to keep your distance, which is probably why it spread so quickly there and so much, you know.
So you're back home, and home is Limerick.
Home's Limerick, yeah.
How are you finding it back home?
It's actually been really nice. I haven't lived here since I was 17. I moved to Dublin for college and I kind of stayed up there working and everything. And it's just been really nice to have this time at home with my family and to, I suppose, I don't know, kind of switch off. I felt like life was going at such a fast pace. Yeah. And if it wasn't for this, we all probably wouldn't have learned to slow down a little bit, you know. It's weird. I kind of look at it like everything happens for a reason, and mm-hmm. I have kind of a new attitude for life afterwards. You know, there's a lot of things I'd change in the ways that I was living, you know.
Particularly given that you're an influencer and one of the biggest ones in the country, 200,000 followers on Instagram, it's a beast that has to be fed very, very regularly, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's difficult as well. Is like you always have to be thinking, like, how am I going to share content? How am I going to help people who are following me? And for me, it was always people followed me for fashion and for things like that, for, you know, ideas, inspiration. Yeah. But then I'm at home and there's nothing really happening and I've nowhere to go. So I had to rethink how I did everything. Yeah. So I started doing kind of like baking videos and at-home workouts. I did chats with career coaches because obviously a lot of people during this time have had their careers turned upside down. And I did chats with life coaches because I know so many people are kind of rethinking everything, you know, and it was great. It was a nice change for me, and it was really helpful, I think, for my followers, and I think they appreciated that as well.
Yeah, and it continued to grow.
Yeah, no, it's been good since I've been home, you know.
I mean,
so that's good.
We tend to be maybe a bit dismissive of influencers and thinking that's all kind of, you know, fake world, but it is, what you're doing has been very important for your followers, for people, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose, like, because it's just you're showing small snippets, you're not always getting the full picture. But in times like this, when we're all going through these crazy changes and adjustments, I have a huge platform and I just wanted to, like, help people as much as I could, and kind of keep people inspired and positive. And, you know, it can be hard to do, but I think the more people talk about it and talk about the hard days and how to get through them and all this kind of stuff, I think the more it gets easier for people. And, yeah.
One of the things that people say about in terms of mental health is try not to pick up your phone so much and doing all the scrolling and all that. But that's literally your job. I mean, how do you cope? I mean, do you feel sometimes that this is a thing that you can never switch off? That's just every single day. You have to pick it up first thing in the morning. You have to upload your content, check the content. Mm-hmm. It must be hard on the head every day.
Yeah, that's definitely how I felt before all this, especially in New York, because there was a time difference and a lot of my audience is in Ireland. So I'd wake up and I was already 5 hours behind, you know. Right. So I kind of wake up in a panic, like, oh my God, I have so much to catch up on. But then during all this, like, everyone in my house was working from home and a lot of my work slowed down. So I kind of would wake up and I'd be like, what am I going to do? And I'd go out for a 2-hour walk without my phone. And I never in my life probably have ever had that much time.
Right.
You know, with no pressure.
Yeah.
And it's been so good. It's been so refreshing. It's been so positive, you know, I think. And I know a lot of people have had that as well. Normally, where people are rushing to work, you know, you've got the commute, you've got, you know, all these daily panics. And a lot of them were taken away for a while, as much as it did bring other stresses for people.
Yeah.
It definitely forced us all to slow down,
totally.
Not make plans, not be busy all the time. And sometimes I think that's really good. For me, anyway, I find I like to be busy, I like to be going, but it's when I have that downtime that I kind of feel happiest sometimes, you know?
Brilliant. Now, staycation is the buzzword. And you're talking about changing content. This is what you've been focusing on. Tell us how you have helped the country, basically.
Well, I suppose that's all we can do this summer. So, and we used to work for Tourism Ireland, so I know there are so many amazing places in
nice.
Ireland. But even now, when I'm traveling around, I'm so surprised at all these places I go to. I'm like, what? Like, why would we even go away? Some of the places are nicer.
Yeah.
You know, when I came home, I had to isolate for 2 weeks, and we stayed in a friend's house in Doolin,
yes.
in West Clare.
Beautiful.
Oh my God. I never spent really much time there. I think I passed through.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally like when we were walking around down there, I was like, this is like the Almaty coast of Ireland. It's so but so untouched, you know, so quiet, so like peaceful and Irish, you know.
Yeah.
Especially if you get the nice weather, there's literally nowhere nicer in the world.
Yeah. So what have you been showing your influences in terms of staycations? What have you been promoting?
So, I'm from Limerick, so I actually was working with the Limerick City Council to promote Limerick as a staycation.
Brilliant.
And obviously, you know, when the restrictions were in that you could only travel within your county,
yeah.
then I started kind of really appreciating Limerick and going out to the Ballyhora Mountains and things like that. But there's so much you can do in the city. I kayaked down the river the other day with my sister.
Wow.
And, like, I mean to say, I've lived here and I've been up and down to Limerick for so long, and I've never seen it like that. We were kind of looking around being like, I've looked at this river my whole life, but
yeah.
I've never seen it like this.
You've
you
never
know,
seen
really,
Limerick from the Shannon.
Yeah, it's really peaceful from in here. And then I was down in Wexford last week. I was in Kilmore Quay. I got a camper van for a couple of days at my friend's, which is absolutely gorgeous. It's kind of like the most easterly point nearly of Ireland.
Right.
And the beaches there are just stunning. It looks like something from a movie. Where else was I? I was up in the Mourne Mountains.
Wow.
Got a little
around.
Cottage up there, yeah. And went to Leitrim as well, actually, and kind of did that side of Ireland, which I really have never seen much of before. Like,
yeah.
you know, the Midlands, like waterfalls and, you know, these nice hikes you can do. We did the Stairway to Heaven in Fermanagh.
Wow.
There's so much you can do. Actually, every county in Ireland, I think we're really lucky. We have such a beautiful country. And we're always kind of in such a rush to book our holidays and to go out, you know, that we don't normally appreciate it. And I'm loving on Instagram at the moment, looking at everyone exploring Ireland and really showing it off the way we normally would with
yeah.
other countries.
And there you could have been in an apartment in New York. And it seems like your horizons have been widened by going back, by going back home.
I know, no, totally. I feel like, as I said, everything happens for a reason. And it's really kind of made me rethink what makes me happy and what I actually want from life and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe that lifestyle, that kind of quick-paced lifestyle in New York, maybe that wasn't actually what I wanted and what was making me happy. So, yeah, it's kind of like a blessing in disguise in a way.
You have a 3-year visa, so when it's all over, you have the option of going back.
Yeah, exactly. Like if I decide by Christmas everything's better and, you know, which I don't know if it will be, you know, then I can go back. And that kind of has given me a little like a peace of mind, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm kind of like now thinking about plan B here and I'm happy here with my family and my friends. You can't beat the Irish people, you know, you really can't. And it only took me 6 months away to realize that I'm a little bit older than I was the last time I lived in New York, and
it's
I just really appreciate
positive,
it.
It's a great, positive, upbeat message, and the imagery and everything that you've promoted around the country has been very helpful. So,
thank you.
And where can we? Louise Cooney on Instagram, easy to find by this stage, I presume. But if there are uninitiated people, maybe just louisecooney.com might be the best starting point.
That's it. Perfect.
Listen, thanks a million, and enjoy lovely Limerick.
Oh, thanks so much, Albert.
Thanks, Louise. Good morning
Bye.
To you.
Bye.
Take care. Welcome back. The text 51551. You can email also ryan@rte.ie. Now, let me tell you about athlete Nikki Daly. Her 2020 was pretty much mapped out from the moment the Irish hockey team qualified for the Olympic Games last November. It would all revolve around Tokyo. And then, of course, the thing happened and the 2020 Olympics, which was supposed to start last weekend, but instead they're happening next year. So Ireland's athletes and athletes all over the world have been left in limbo. Nikki joins us this morning. We've loads to talk about. Those delays to the Olympics, calling it quits after Tokyo and getting into the family business of motorsport. Good morning to you, Nikki.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, what would you be doing right now in Japan had things gone according to plan?
Well, I suppose we'd be playing in the tournament. I don't even know what day it is. What day is today? Wednesday. I'm not even sure who we'd be playing, but yeah, we'd be competing, that's for sure.
And you'd be in the Olympic Village and you'd be eyeing everybody up and trying to see...
we'd be taking it all in. I mean, obviously, It was the first time we'd qualified for the Olympics ever, the female team.
Yeah.
So we would have been taking in absolutely every bit of it, the village, you know, the pitch, the surrounding areas, all the other athletes and the different sports. So, yeah, it's quite a different day, I suppose, to what we could have been doing.
Do you think about it now, or are you kind of over it because you've known for a good few months?
I think I would have thought about it a little bit kind of towards around, you know, when the selection was supposed to be made, and then obviously around the time when we were due to fly out there, kind of, I actually happened to be on a building site that day.
Wow.
You know, just thinking that how this could have been so different.
Yeah.
But since then, I think, you know, just kind of had to get on with it. We're back to training now since last week with the squad, and it's kind of been nice to get back into things, and you're kind of starting from fresh, you know, mentally and physically. So it's been nice to get back, and I think I haven't been thinking about it as much as maybe I was beforehand.
Particularly because you were coming in off a huge momentum from the 2018 World Cup, and people will remember the excitement of that, finishing with a silver medal. And, I mean, what is the mood like when you went back to training last week among the team?
I think everyone was excited to get back, you know. It's definitely the longest that any of us have probably been out from the game. Like, not having held a stick in 4 months is a very long time in international sport anyway. So, the girls were all in great form last week and just excited to get back into it, you know, to have a programme set out. We do have a full-time programme starting again in September. And that's something that I think everyone's looking forward to, kind of getting back into that and preparing now for this time next year.
Because that's from September, essentially, you're full on again, preparing for the Olympics again. Having to do it twice, which has never happened before.
No, but I think, you know, everyone's in the same boat. Like, all athletes, all teams all over the world are in the same boat. So we're not at any sort of a disadvantage. And in fact, I think, you know, with every kind of challenge that presents, there's always opportunity. And, you know, certainly for us, we've had a new coach come in who's only been with us maybe less than a year before the pandemic set in. And, you know, to have another year with Sean as the coach and to kind of hone in on his way of playing and his style of play can only really benefit us, I think, going into next year. And, you know, it gives that opportunity for any younger players to really kind of make their mark. And I think it'll just increase the level of the team overall. So, you know, I don't think we're at too much of a disadvantage from it.
That's something I wouldn't have thought about, that you can have younger players coming in that may not have made this summer but might come in next year.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a positive.
I mean, then you have the other end of the scale with the older players like me who, you know, another year is probably like, oh, you know, a little bit too much, but hopefully, you know, it won't be. But yeah, you've got like, you know, two sides of it there that, you know, you've got the younger players and also the older players who are, you know, we're probably looking to kind of finish after this cycle.
I mean, old in sports terms in hockey world is 32. That's your age now. So your plan was do the Olympics and then retire from the international element, I presume.
Yeah, I mean, I've been part of the squad now for over 10 years. And I kind of just seen my life taking a bit of a different direction maybe after this cycle. So, you know, one more year is not that long to some people, but it is when you're an international athlete.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been obviously the Olympics has always been the dream, and getting there last November was just the best feeling ever, that, you know, you kind of put yourself through anything that you have to give yourself the best chance of getting there. So, you know, as tough as another year will be, I'm certainly going to give it everything I can and hope to be there next year.
Is it going to be harder preparing a year later than it was last year, if you know what I mean? Is there a psychological element to it?
Yeah, I think there's always a bit of, you know, psychological, obviously physical as well. You know, you kind of, you hope that the body can hang on for another year and not have any injuries. But I think, you know, it gives you a little bit more time to prepare, you know, like from November to July was less than a year to really make sure that you had everything. Like I said, we had a new coach and you're trying to perfect certain things that maybe he wants from you. And so it does give you an extra year to kind of, you know, make sure that you are practicing or getting better at those little bits that he wants you to be better at. So I think it can only benefit us in the long run.
Take us back to 2 years ago. It's 2018. It's the World Cup. People probably in parts of the country hadn't paid much attention to hockey before that summer, but it changed everything, didn't it?
Yeah, it certainly did. I mean, you know, probably most of the country had never heard of an Irish hockey team before. Mm. And, you know, I think the couple of weeks that we were in London in July 2018 certainly changed all that. And it's fantastic now to see sort of the recognition that we have got, and that people are continuing to follow the Irish hockey team, you know, as we go along, which is brilliant. And, you know, people are genuinely supporting it now and looking out for it and excited to see what we can do next. I think everyone was probably looking forward to seeing how the Irish hockey team got on in the Olympic Games. So,
yeah,
it's brilliant. It's brilliant to put such a maybe small sport in this country on the map the way we did. And, you know, for people to be aware of it now and to support it the way they have.
And, I mean, that enthusiasm will return again in a year's time. There's no doubt about it. But I suppose you've had four months off training and off the game. That must have been kind of nice maybe for yourself, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Like, you know, the training is very intense, and we were at a very intense period. We were certainly kind of trying to peak. Obviously, the Olympics were only 4 months away when the pandemic set in. So we were in a very different phase than we are now. And the break was, it was kind of nice to, you know, not have that pressure of having to perform and the pressure of, you know, getting through training and the kind of the physicality of it and the mental kind of toughness that it brought as well. So, it was really nice. I think everyone probably enjoyed a little bit of the break. Might have been a little bit too long in some people's eyes, but it's great now that we're back and, you know, hopefully all going well. We can just keep building up and ramping up the program by getting a few competitive games in, hopefully maybe this side of this year, if not like starting next year.
Yeah.
It's great to finally be back and have something to look forward to now, and take away one less unknown.
And it was a nice chance to probably hang out with your family. And you have a very interesting family background. You spent your childhood weekends down in Mondello Park.
Yeah, that's where I spent most of my childhood, actually. Yeah. Was down in Mondello. Obviously, my dad was a racing driver, so his career was most important at that time. And, yeah, we were down there every weekend supporting him. And that's pretty much where I developed sort of a passion for motorsport and the motor industry.
And you still have it.
Yeah. I'm doing a lot of work. I've set up an organisation called Formula Female, which is to, you know, increase the female participation in motorsport, but not just motorsport, sort of in the motor industry itself. And, you know, you're talking about drivers, engineers, mechanics, you know, working in the motor industry in terms of sales, technicians, everything like that. So it's trying to, you know, obviously motorsport is a sport that's heavily imbalanced in terms of gender and diversity. So it's trying to increase or close that gap even, that gender balance gap a little bit by increasing the representation of females in the industry.
It's a brilliant legacy in terms of the motivation and passion that your dad left you. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us.
Yeah, no, he was, I suppose, the one thing I remember about him was just how professional he was about, you know, how he went about motorsport. And, you know, it wasn't exactly a professional setup in Ireland, although he took it as it was and he presented himself as though he was a professional in the sport. And I think that was really important to actually elevate the sport as well here in Ireland. So even though it's not considered professional, you know, or hockey's not considered professional, and I'm not considered a professional athlete, doesn't mean to say that you can't be professional about what you do and try and, you know, grow your sport to become that bit more professional even by the way it operates. So I think that's something that I've definitely learned from him that I've tried to take forward into different aspects of my life going forward. So. Yeah.
So on your way to founding Formula Female, it really was the route was engineering and education, wasn't it?
Yeah, for me, I mean, I never actually became a racing driver as much as I wanted to when I was younger. It was through my education, you know, I did mechanical engineering in IT Tala and then went on to do a master's in motorsport engineering in the States. And it was sort of through that experience of being the only female in my engineering courses, and then
the only one.
Yeah, well, I was one of two in the masters I did in England, but I was the only girl in my engineering course here in Ireland. And when I went to work in the States, I was again the only kind of only female engineer. There was obviously other women that worked in the team, but I was the only engineer that worked for them. And it was that sort of experience of working and my education where I realized that there were so few girls that did this, and I'd love to open it up and make more females aware of this as a potential career, because, you know, my office was the pit lane and I had these cars at 200 miles an hour going past me down the racetrack, and I just thought this was incredible, you know, this
is the thrill
more
of
people
the life.
Need to know about this.
And
that's sort of where the idea or the concept came from, was to try and, you know, open this sport up for more young girls and to show that the opportunities that are in the sport. And that's kind of, it's grown so much from there, you know. We're lucky to be backed the Go Girls Karting initiative that I set up, which is to introduce over 1,000 schoolgirls to karting and STEM, which is science, technology, engineering and maths.
Brilliant.
Is backed by an Irish motorsport team called CJJ Motorsports. So it's, you know, the idea is not just to kind of have this once-off event or anything like that. It's sort of a long-term goal that both, you know, CJJ have kind of set out in terms of trying to open up opportunities for young drivers, engineers, mechanics, to actually give them the chance to possibly create a career in the sport. And, you know, we've seen that already with Nicole Drought, who's now being backed by CJJ Motorsports in the UK in the Endurance Brick Car Championship.
Yeah.
And, you know, she won her first race a couple of weeks ago, which is fantastic. And these opportunities wouldn't arise without sort of the long-term planning of teams like CJJ Motorsports and the Go Girls Initiative. So it's really exciting.
It's a brilliant time to think about it, because a lot of people would be, a lot of women in particular, now is the time they're sitting back and wondering about career when this thing is all over.
Yeah.
And the opportunities that are there are massive. I mean, if there is somebody there who are listening and they're thinking, maybe this is, you know, engineering, motorsport could be for me, where would you start? Where would you tell them to start?
I'd say start by coming to our initiative if they're young
Go
enough.
Go Girls Karting Initiative.
Go Girls Karting Initiative, yeah. We use, obviously, motorsport as a platform to teach science, technology, engineering and math. So we try and bring those subjects to life and make it fun for them. But if, you know, if you're at a time in their life where maybe they're going into sixth year and they're trying to decide what it is they want to do, certainly I think engineering is so broad and it opens up so many doors that motorsport is always one of them. And if it's adrenaline that you're interested in, and it's you know, that kind of life on the road, getting to travel and stuff like that, it's definitely something for someone like that. But yeah, I think engineering is such a broad subject that you can go into so many different avenues with it. You know,
and motorsport as well, because it's a very male dominated sport, isn't it? And the lack of exposure is probably is the key problem there.
Yeah, it is, and I suppose that's one of the main objectives of the karting initiative that we run, is that, you know, we're trying to increase that awareness and increase the awareness at a young age, so that people. These young girls can see that this is an option. This is something that they can actually do, and that it is something that's out there. So, you know, I think if I wish I had it when I was younger, because it certainly would have helped me on the path to getting to engineering a little bit easier.
Yeah. By the way, do you have any sports idols in the racing world that you look up to?
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, a female idol, obviously, our homegrown Rosemary Smith would have been one. Danica Patrick is a woman who's just finished her racing career. She was the first woman to win an IndyCar race. So they are probably the two female role models that I have in the sport.
Yeah.
Obviously, since I've started working in the sport, I've come across a lot of female engineers and mechanics as well who I've looked up to and kind of thought that was pretty cool that they've gotten to the top of the sport through engineering, like Lena Gade. She's a 3-time Le Mans 24-hour winner race engineer.
Right.
So there's so many great stories out there and great role models out there that, you know, I've looked up to, and it's about me now trying to pass that on to the next generation and give them someone to look up to show them that they can do it too.
Well, Nikki, there are people looking up to you because we have a text in, "Go girl, so proud of you, the world is yours." And you probably will go into motorsport a lot more after Tokyo 2020, which is happening next year, and beyond.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's definitely, I suppose, you look at hockey on one side, and if you look at, you know, gender inequality or gender balance, we're obviously way more represented in hockey on the female side, and
yeah,
it's fantastic to see that in the sport, and females get highlighted so much more in the hockey world. And I suppose coming from that side and then having the motorsport side where it's so underrepresented, I think that's where I've come from a place where, you know, it's all about, say, female hockey players and how great those girls are looked after and how much they inspire and the next generation, that I feel like that there's a bit more of a need for change on the motorsport side. And I kind of feel like that's where I can put my energy and my experience.
Well, you're doing it. You're doing a great job of it so far. And you just announced you're joining, because we know brand ambassadors for car companies and so on are usually men. But tell us about your new partnership.
Yeah, so I've just joined MSL Grange Motors as a brand ambassador for them. And again, like, it goes back to the female representation in the motor industry. This partnership works for both me and for MSL because they are committed to increasing their female representation in their own company.
Brilliant.
And I think that's just brilliant for a big company like MSL to be conscious of that and to try and close that gender gap. And for me to be able to help them in whatever way, capacity that I can, is really exciting for me and for them. So I'm really looking forward to working with MSL
you get to drive a Mercedes as well, which is awesome.
And I get to drive a nice Mercedes.
But more importantly, glass ceilings. That's what you're breaking all over the place. So, Nikki, I mean, we'll be watching with interest what you do in the hockey world in a year's time, and of course in motorsport as well. And we wish you nothing but the best.
Thanks very much, and thanks for having me.
Not at all. You're very welcome. The Go Girls STEM initiative is something you can seek out and find out more about what Nikki is up to in terms of getting to motorsport through engineering. The world is hers, the world is yours, so go get it. That's Nikki Daly speaking to us there. The text is 51551. We'll be back after this. And welcome back. Tis Oliver Callan here in for Mr. Tubridy. And before me is Emer McLysett, co-author of the Aisling Phenomenon columnist.
Thank you for saying phenomenon.
Yes. And lifelong fan of the late, great, wondrous Maeve Binchy.
Yes, definitely.
So we are here because Circle of Friends, I have it here beside me, it's a hefty tome,
700
isn't it?
Pages.
It is 30 years old.
It is. Can you believe it?
Yeah, can you believe it? So obviously, when did you first, did you see the film first or did you read the book first?
I was trying to, so I wrote a piece about the kind of the 30th anniversary of, yes, Circle of Friends, and it's actually the 25th anniversary of the movie. It came out in 1995.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, did I see the film first or did I read the book first? And I've convinced myself that I must have seen the film first because I love the film.
Right.
And I think, like, the film has a lot of nostalgic love, and people are really, you know, a lot of people would have seen it at a certain period in their lives and, you know, it meant a lot to them. But I think if you had read the book first and then seen the film, you might be a bit like, I mean, yeah, it has its charms, but it's not the book. So I read the book after the movie. So I think that's why the movie also has such a special place in my heart.
It really
I'm trying to be very
place.
Diplomatic because Maeve Binchy was involved in the writing of the movie. So.
Okay. But she was involved in it.
She was involved to a certain extent, yeah. But I saw the movie when I was about 14. And
yes.
Chris O'Donnell, who's this American guy with the big teeth, plays Jack Foley, the Irish handsome doctor's son. And he, at the time, was a big ride. So
hard to kind of believe that he was the kind of pin-up of the day.
Maybe
anyway.
It was around the time he played Robin in Batman and Robin.
It's
and
same
he was
year,
in Scent of a Woman, I think. So he would have been, I would have had a poster on my wall. So he definitely was a big draw. But I loved Maeve Binchy anyway around that time. Lots of Maeve Binchy books in our house. I would have read Evening Class. There was probably a copy of Circle of Friends in the house anyway, and it was just a matter of time before I picked it up.
Well, you're obsessed, aren't you?
Yeah. Well, like, so, yeah. Kind
have you
of
had
obsessed.
Counselling over the Circle?
I'm obsessed with kind of a lot of kind of books of that genre written by Irish women. Yeah. Like, I just, they mean a lot to me.
Well, it has huge depth to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, as we said, it is 700 pages long and it only takes place over one academic year. So it's the year in the life of Benny Hogan, who moves from down home up to Dublin to go to college. And it's a year in her life and her circle of friends. So 700 pages for 1 year, but it doesn't feel, I mean, it looks huge. You have a copy of it there. It looks huge in front of us, but when you're reading it, it flies by. You fly through it, yeah.
I mean, because if someone's experience of Circle of Friends, which is like me, is only of the film, you wouldn't really realise how deep and how...
It's
almost like a social history of Ireland in there.
It really is. Like, and they do cover... I mean, as somebody who is... Like, me and my co-author, Sarah Breen, are currently adapting the first Aisling book into a movie.
Yes.
And our book is nowhere near 700 pages long. And trying to condense our relatively short book into a 90-minute film...
is hard enough.
It's the hardest challenge. It's really, really difficult. So I think what they did with the Circle of Friends movie is actually quite admirable in terms of what they managed to get from the book. I mean, it is essentially the story, but the book is just so much more detailed and nuanced, and the film is more kind of like girl meets boy, girl falls for boy, will girl get boy, girl isn't as attractive as boy, whereas the book is much more nuanced, as they always are.
And I mean, you've described in that piece you wrote for The Independent, I think it was a week ago or so, that Benny is kind of us, and you almost resent her for that.
Yeah, I mean, she's so deeply uncool, and like she's so relatable, and people say that about Aisling because she's quite uncool as well, but she's so relatable, and she kind of moves through the world in a way in which a lot of Irish women can relate to, I think. Mm-hmm. And she has, you know, friends that are smaller than her and who are more glamorous than her or more elegant than her, and she just feels like in the film they kind of play on that a lot, and she talks about, you know, her bosom being like the prow of a ship and that she's, you know, beefed to the heel like a Mullingar heifer.
Great.
So she's just very relatable, and I think there's a lot of Maeve Binchy in Benny, and she did talk about that you know, when she had written the book, because she went to UCD like Benny does, and she was the tallest girl in the class, probably taller than the boys as well.
Yeah. And because the women are living in a men's world, I mean, it's 1950s Ireland.
Yeah.
The casting of Chris O'Donnell made a very soft portrayal, really, of him.
Very soft. He has a very sympathetic portrayal in the movie compared to in the book.
And so how different? Tell us how different it is.
Well, I mean, I suppose without giving too much away, but I mean, if you don't know the ending by now, it's 30 years on, so you're a bit late. It's like people who complain about giving away the ending of Sopranos, like, come on. I suppose it's clearest at the end, because at the end of the film, it's quite syrupy, and Benny and so Jack in the book and the film really, really lets her down. So he builds up her confidence. He tells her he loves her, and we really believe he loves her. And then he goes off with her best friend.
Yeah.
And at the end of the film, it all comes back together in a lovely syrupy Hollywood ending. But in the book, it's Benny who's standing among her circle of friends, and Jack is on the outside, and it's much more ambiguous as to, you know, will they get back together? Probably not. Like, he hurt her too much. And I think that was really brave of Maeve Binchy to do in the 90s.
It's girl power, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, de rigueur now to leave something ambiguous. I mean, Sally Rooney does it, Nisha Dolan does it in her recent book. But for Maeve Binchy to do it, I think it was probably quite brave, and the filmmakers weren't quite as brave, because if you're making a rom-com, people want the happy ending. So,
because I always wondered, what did Maeve Binchy think of the film, but given that it changed so much and actually kind of changed almost the meaning of it.
Yeah.
The circle of friends are the women, and they actually are very much stronger in the book in terms of, you know, their confidence and so on.
They are, yeah, they are. Although I think the film does do a good job in kind of putting forward the three women as the circle of friends. I mean, it does spring to mind. And I think what the film does do, whenever anyone says to me, oh, Circle of Friends, I love that film, you always automatically go, but have you read the book? But have you read the book? You have to read the book. And people do tend to go and read the book, because people are kind of evangelical about it.
There's a clip here of Maeve Binchy, the late Maeve Binchy, and she's actually asked, what did she make of the film and her thoughts of it? Have a listen to this.
I used to say, well, sure, if they make a great success of it, I should smile bashfully and stamp the ground and say, oh, it was nothing really, and thank you. And if they make a complete mess of it, I can just say, sadly, they destroyed my beautiful story. So one way or the other, you're going to win. And I've been very pleased. I loved Circle of Friends when that was done. And it's lovely to think that people still look at it. It's often on at Christmas or Easter, bank holiday times on the television. And it's on film. They got on a plane once and they were showing it on the plane. And I was delighted. I wanted to tell people to stop. stop drinking and eating. Yes. And pay attention, please. There may be questions afterwards, so you might as well look at it now.
That's Maeve.
That is, I've never heard that before, because I feel like it's on every bank holiday.
Yeah, that's 10 years ago. It's still true.
This Sunday night is a bank holiday. If it's not on somewhere, I'm going to be disappointed.
Well, she loved the film, and she had this extra. She obviously saw there was a function for the film separate to the
it's,
book.
I think it's always dangerous when a book is turned into a film, because people have such fondness for books, and they tend to go to those first, and then they're like, they're going to destroy it. I mean, I have that fear big time. So I think her attitude is perfect.
I mean, even with the accents and everything. I mean, it's kind of nostalgic, quaint bad.
I think Minnie Driver, so is she American or is she English? She's
English.
She does a great American accent, and she is English. Her Irish accent isn't that bad.
It's not. I agree. I only saw it for the first time last night.
Yeah.
And it's almost like a modern Irish accent that she was doing 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Actually, we have it. This is Nan, though. This is not Minnie Driver. And Jack, who really, Chris O'Donnell his Irish accent is the pits.
But it's kind of absolute wojus.
It's kind of nostalgically wojus, isn't it?
Hey, Nan.
Hello, Jack.
Looking very lovely as always.
Thank you. So are you.
You're very kind.
You're very welcome.
Are you coming to the match today?
We might.
Well, see you there if you do.
See you there if you do.
Wow.
You're laughing way too much at that. It's even worse than his opening line.
I've kind of forgotten how bad it was.
His opening line is like, will you say up to Murphy's tonight? They go over the top and the eyes.
Ah, Benny.
Are we delighted?
But I mean, there's no way, like, Chris O'Donnell was never going to be Irish. There's no Irish man in the world who has a head like that and the big smile and the teeth. Yes. So, I mean, you were almost expecting the accent to come out, and you were like, look, we'll give them the pass. They got the big Hollywood star. We let
them have
it.
Sold the film all over the world.
It really did.
And it was a huge hit. Yeah. It was made for 15 million. It made like 50, 60 million. It was huge in Japan. Yeah. I saw last night, which is very strange. Because it's a universal language, isn't it? She was speaking.
I mean, yeah, the book definitely has a lot of universal themes. And actually, in the piece I wrote for The Independent, it was, what are the themes that are in the book that are still so relevant today? Because there are still people today picking up Circle of Friends in their droves. And I noticed from being on Twitter and following a lot of younger people that there are people, it's always talked about. And whenever it is on a bank holiday Sunday, there's a conversation started again, and there are so many themes in it that are universal. And I suppose the film also paints Ireland in a really gorgeous light.
Like, yes, it does look.
It was filmed in a town in Kilkenny, and that looks beautiful.
And Inishtig.
Yeah, and it just looks beautiful. I think there is a restaurant in Inishtig called Circle of Friends.
Okay, they're really catchy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And 30 years on, and there are kind of, it is a book, even if you've seen the film, there's so much more in the book.
Oh, there's so much more in the book, yeah.
How influential was Maeve Binchy as an author, even outside of Circle of Friends, everything else she did?
I would say hugely. Like, she wrote a lot. So, the issue with Maeve Binchy was that she was seen as books for mams, books for grannies.
Mammy's books.
Women in their sick bed, women in hospital. By her Maeve Binchy. Whereas she was writing such, on massive scales about social issues, about class issues, about relationships, about women in Ireland. And she was a woman who kind of, much like Benny, she kind of saw herself as, I'm always going to be on the shelf. I'm not one of those slim, pretty girls who gets picked by the handsome rugby player.
Yeah.
So she kind of went on and worked really hard at her writing and moved to London. And, she kind of really made that her business, was to write about women in Ireland. And she kind of, Sarah and I are always like standing on the shoulders of giants, standing on Maeve Binchy's shoulders. What a place to be. Like, she really set us up. She was covering, like, Circle of Friends is set in the 50s and it deals with abortion. And it's not in an extremely shocking way. It's in a very, almost a matter of fact way. Like, it happens and they deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk, it's in the film as well, about procuring the French letters.
Yes.
Because obviously contraception was illegal in the 50s in Ireland, and in fact was only legalised, I think, in 1985 in Ireland. So 5 years before Circle of Friends was published.
Wow.
So there's a lot, I would say a lot of the young women especially who might have been involved in campaigning for repeal, or even women who just voted for repeal, reading that can go, God, I can really, this
and
is...
And are millennials reading Maeve Binchy now?
They absolutely are, yeah. Yeah, I spoke to a few actually for the piece that I worked on. I just put something out on Twitter and I said, I'm looking for people kind of in their late 20s, early 30s, who have read it recently for the first time. And I got so many messages. And they said they related to this idea of, you know, moving down home and going up to the big smoke. That was something they really, really universal. They really related to Benny's body image issues, as, you know, she was, you know, beef to the heels. Yeah. And as was
everybody is gorgeous in the city, and suddenly you think, well, I'm the country bumpkin.
Exactly, exactly. And they related to, as I said, some of the social issues that she brought up, the talk of abortion, the talk of, like, Benny's friend Nan comes from kind of a violent working class background and is kind of striving to get out of it, and, you know, wants
violence.
And wants to meet kind of, you know, a rich, you know, Protestant, for want of a better words, to kind of lift her up out of that poverty because she feels like she deserves better.
Well, tweets are coming in. Listening to Emer talking about Maeve Binchy's Circle of Friends and dying to reread it now. Great to hear the book discussed in this deep way, says Jackie Lynham. And the good news is you can actually get it. It is everything that Maeve Binchy has written is still in print, because we
went look for a copy. 40 million books she sold worldwide. Yeah.
Wow. If you're starting out with Maeve Binchy, like, what are the books you would recommend?
I would say if you wanted to start with Circle of Friends, because it is very much standalone. She has a couple of books that are kind of sequels
related,
or kind of Tara Road is another one that's very popular. That's one of her biggest ones. Firefly Summer.
That was a movie as well, wasn't Tara Road?
I think so, yeah.
Firefly Summer.
I loved Evening Class, was one of my favourites.
Wow.
And I think Quentin's is a follow up to Evening Class. I hope I'm right about that. Yeah. But that's just a couple of...
Wasn't Light a Penny Candle? Was that her bestseller?
Yeah, I think it was one of her bestsellers, yeah.
She just has such a huge...
But Circle of Friends is such an amazing standalone, and it is 700 pages, but it's worth it. Like, you can really get lost in it.
Lelia, pronouncing all the names wrong today. I've just finished the three Aisling books, which were dropped my door during COVID. Desperate for a read. I can tell you, I kept my husband awake with my laugh out loud moments. I often wake during the night to pick up the book to read. I seriously had to put my hand over my mouth while shaking with laughter. Thanks. Looking forward to the film. Also loved Maeve Binchy. Read all her books. More Aisling books, please.
Oh, isn't that lovely to hear? There will be some more Aisling books.
Yes. Are we getting one this year?
There'll be one in 2021. We have a little Aisling surprise coming before the end of the year, but 2021 will be book
Aisling
4.
Surprise.
Yeah.
It's because the film is interrupted.
Well, we're actually currently working on the screenplay. So we've been working on that. We're working with Element, who just made Normal People. So no pressure there. Described as, you know, the best adaptation of a novel ever. Yeah. And me and Sarah are just like, ours might be good as well.
Is it cast and everything, by the
way? No, not yet. No.
Okay.
So it
we're
goes.
Just dying for information.
It goes screenplay, director, casting, and then.
And so it's just covering book one.
Just covering book one.
Oh,
yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, but I love to hear that woman who texted in saying the books that, because I would.
There's loads of them here.
I mentioned Rachel's Holiday by Marion Keyes in the Independent piece.
You did. I read it as a result of reading
your
recommendation.
Enjoy it?
Absolutely amazing. I don't think I've ever had a last line in a book that made me laugh out loud.
Absolutely hilarious.
And it's amazing.
I just noticed last night, I have Rachel's Holiday constantly beside my bed, and I would often just pick it up and open it on a page and just laugh.
Because there are one-liners everywhere.
One-liners. It's just so perfect. I think it's
funny, so dark.
It's up there with Circle of Friends as classic Irish literature. Like, it's just so representative.
Do you think they're getting their due now?
I think they're starting to, yeah. I think there's definitely a pushback on this idea that women's... I remember when Sarah and I started writing books and we were told by publishers, oh, so you fall into the category of women's fiction or commercial fiction. And I was like, I didn't really realise that was a category. Is there a men's fiction? No, of course not. Because God forbid a man might pick up a book meant for a woman.
Yeah.
So... But there is definitely pushback. There's definitely kind of a blurring of this line between kind of high and low culture. And if something's very popular, then it can't be good. If something's funny, it can't be good.
In fact, there was a man, wasn't there, who recently slammed genre fiction, said he wouldn't be doing it.
Yes, there was.
A very well-known writer.
Was.
And I think it was Marion Keyes' response, says the man who did a pastiche of Maeve Binchy.
Yeah, exactly.
The novel was called Brooklyn.
And Sheila O'Flanagan, who's another, you know, very well-respected Irish writer, but again falls into that kind of commercial fiction. She said that if Brooklyn had been written by Colleen Tobin, then we might not have ever seen it be such a big hit, or it might not have ever got the plaudits that it did. I mean, you can't say that for certain. I love Brooklyn, it's a great book, but
own it.
Exactly.
Maeve Binchy's Desert Island Disc interview is well worth a listen, says this texter. This is Aoife, if you want to learn more about her. I'm going to check that out as well.
Yeah.
Somebody asked, was Ryan Tuberty an extra in Circle of Friends? Yes, he was.
Oh my God, he was.
At the very end. I was told to watch out for him, would I spot him, and you can't miss him.
Get him on the phone.
Strolling through. Interrupt his staycation. He's on his holidays.
Loads and loads of lovely stuff. Anyway, so we're going to have there's a little Aisling surprise later in the year.
Yeah, we'll be announcing it in the next couple of weeks and it'll be a little Aisling surprise.
And oh my God, what a complete Aisling. The movie.
It will hopefully be coming, I mean, in the next... It depends really on the
depends
pandemic.
On when you can film.
Yeah, it depends on when you can film. Depends on when we can get our dream cast.
Yeah. And will the... I'm just thinking, will the next Aisling book, will it be in lockdown?
That is what we are currently chatting about. Yeah, because we had kind of decided last year, you know, we've agreed to read 5 books and we had decided that we were going to... you know, it was going to go a certain way. But now we're kind of like, well, Aisling in lockdown, like it's almost her dream.
Yes.
She's going to be raging. She never became a nurse because it would have been her time to shine. The 2 metres, she would have been all over it.
Yes.
The curtain
policing
twitching,
it.
You know, that's 2.1 kilometres, all over it.
Homemade
in shops,
hand sanitizer.
Tutting, like just. So I think, yeah, we're going to have to go back to the drawing board.
Wow. So there's going to be a fresh Aisling, but we're not going to see it until maybe... Next year.
The
film comes first. Yeah. I need to know more information. But thank you so much. I've gone way over, but it was just too much to talk about.
So
Maeve Binchy's Circle of Friends is in all good bookshops now.
It sure is.
And there's also stuff we didn't get to. There's shocking incidents I didn't know in the book that are in the book, but not in the film. But the film is nice, as a bank holiday, rainy day.
The film is nice. I would say compliment them. Read the film read the book and watch the film and you'll be delighted.
Outside of Circle of Friends, what's your Maeve Binchy number one choice?
Oh, Evening Class.
Evening Class.
Yeah.
There you go. You have your instructions. Eimear MacLeish, it's been rather lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And to all the Aislings in our lives, the beautiful, wonderful. Where would we be without them? We better go to a break. Now, Italia 90 is the subject of a new exhibition opening today at the Little Museum of Dublin. It, of course, had a profound impact on the country and was central to the brilliant novel and subsequent film, The Van. Its author, Roddy Doyle, is on the line. Good morning, Roddy.
Hello.
We better start, I suppose, with the death of Jack Charlton just a couple of weeks ago and the almost spooky timing of it.
Yes, it's as if he somehow choreographed the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because I think the Italia 90 was being somewhat bypassed because of the lockdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't getting the attention that a lot lesser events get when their anniversaries come along. Mm. And then he died.
Mm. And
I suppose some of us thought he was going to be a bit immortal. But, you know, the notion of Jack Charlton dying was just ludicrous. But there you go.
And you published a pretty poignant the 2 Pints tribute to Big Jack himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it had that line, I feel like me da's after dying.
Yeah.
But that was it. He was Ireland's dad, wasn't he?
In a way, yeah. I mean, at the time, I didn't think it, you know. Say, Italia 90, I was 32. I had a father of my own.
Yeah.
And one's plenty. My father was a very lively man. There wouldn't have been room for another father in my life, you know. But I think that's what he became almost, really, because I remember when he got the job in 1986, I don't remember anybody thinking this is great news. He wasn't anybody's first choice. He almost got in by accident. And I went to the first friendly game, and it wasn't a glittering affair. My outstanding memory is that Neville Southall, the Wales goalkeeper, broke his leg, you know, in a friendly because of the state of the pitch, really. He landed in a ditch, you know. So it wasn't a great thing, but gradually then. And I went to some of the friendlies before 1988, the friendly games. There was one against Bulgaria, if I remember rightly, in Lansdowne Road. And because there were no floodlights, they were on a Wednesday afternoon, and I was a teacher, so I had the afternoon off. And I could sit on the terrace and have a perfect view of the game. There were so few people there, you know.
Right.
And then gradually, as you know, it took off. And by 1990, it was a national obsession is to put it, you know, is an understatement. And it stopped being about the football, because I think if you look at the football, some of those games were pretty dreadful. But it was the atmosphere, the sense that this is us. Christ, we're like this. We can do this. You know, it was amazing. Extraordinary.
Almost nobody else around the world remembers World Cup 90.
No, it's not one of the better ones.
I think it had the fewest goals, actually, of any World Cup ever.
Yeah.
And but we were totally, totally consumed. Do you remember vividly the run-up to it?
I remember, yeah, because In part because I was really looking forward to it. As a football fanatic, really, yeah, since I was a little boy. And I suppose at one time you kind of give up on the idea of ever taking part in this, you know, despite the fact we'd seen Northern Ireland in 1982, mm-hmm, and I think in 86 as well. It just seemed it was never going to happen, and then it did. And I'd started writing The Van, the novel, in November 1989.
Right.
And as the excitement began to build up, I thought, well, I could launch The Van at the same time as the World Cup. And if it takes off, great. And if it doesn't, I'd be editing it anyway, so it won't be in the book. Yeah. But it did take off. And I was writing those long chapters where their business is immediately chaotic, wild success outside the pub. You know, like the day after the matches and the day after that, my head pounding, you know, absolutely dead, right, you know, but delirious in some way. So I think if I'd been in Italy, I'd never written the book, I think. And also, if I hadn't been a football fan, I don't think I'd written the book, because it was the energy of it all. It was so, I have great memories of it, very, very, very vivid memories. I went to all the qualifying games.
Right.
And all the home games. I wasn't at any of the away games. So I went to all of them, and the gradual build-up, the belief, it's going to happen. And then, you know, what should have been the easiest game of the lot, really, away to Malta, it became, typically enough, really, a nail-biting affair, you know.
A bit like in the World Cup itself, where Egypt should have been a prospect that we...
Oh, you know, that's the worst game in history, really. Can we move on?
Yeah. So The Van is like a contemporaneous account. You're writing it hungover after the matches.
Yes, big chunks of it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The hard work then was later on editing it, but also, you know, there was, if you like, I wrote the, if you like, the centre of the book was written then, but the problem came later after the World Cup, when I had to come up with an ending and, you know, make a novel out of it, as opposed to the wild ramblings of a football fan.
Can we just take a little step back, and I want to look at Italia 90, because obviously it was Jack Charlton. We didn't hardly see him as English, even though he was, he was in the World Cup 1966 with England. But the whole team, none of them earned a living in Ireland.
No.
And yet they managed to represent this kind of much broader view of Irishness than we ever had before.
Yeah, that's one of the things. There's a great image in the little museum exhibition. It's a map of Ireland and Britain with arrows indicating where the players came from.
Right.
You know, and despite, you know, popular myth, quite a few of the arrows point at Ireland. But the one that got me was Kevin Sheedy. I thought I knew the name of every town everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
There's a football team from every town everywhere, or a train station that you look out the window. Oh, there it is. But Kevin Sheedy came from a place I never heard of. And
go on, what is it?
I can't remember. I suppose it's a big enough enticement for people to go in and have a go.
Yeah, it's in the little museum. That's like
But I think it was really perfect in many, many ways, you know, because what Irish family doesn't have family living abroad?
Yeah.
People who are passionate about their Irishness, more so than we are. They'd embarrass you, you know, on occasion, as you know, with Irish dancing and stuff like that. And it just seemed right and proper that, you know, Ray Houghton, for example, whose father was from Donegal, if I remember right, should be allowed to consider himself an Irishman and should, you know, should score against England, you know. So it was a bigger definition of Ireland. And I think that was significant as well, because I think around about that time, really, the notion that Ireland was an island unto itself and had, you know, nothing to do with the rest of the world was well and truly dying. And we began to look outside to really become Europeans, I think. And I think that bringing in people who weren't living in Ireland anymore was just seemed to represent that somehow. And I think Jack Charlton, his brand of Englishness was important.
Right.
He wasn't Jacob Rees-Mogg.
No.
Do you know? He didn't really have to fight too hard to be liked. He was from Northern England. And anybody who spent time, say, in Liverpool or Manchester, they all feel a little bit familiar, those places, because they're so, in many senses, Irish, you know. Now, he had nothing Irish about him, but he was just that Northern, blunt, honest, decent, for want of a better word. man.
When he got off the plane, the Aer Lingus plane home from Dublin, which was rechristened St. Jack, the actual plane, the scenes of the homecoming after, you know, Ewan's glorious defeat in a way, it was kind of approaching mania, wasn't it?
It was unbelievable. I mean, I was on O'Connell Bridge. I lived on Abbey Street at the time, and I spent literally hours on O'Connell Bridge waiting for the buses to come down O'Connell Street. And it looked visually as if they were being carried, yeah, you know, carried by the crowd up along, gradually along the street. I've never seen crowds like it. Yeah. I haven't since. It was just extraordinary, and people were hanging from everything. I believe some of the men on the buses were actually quite frightened that somebody was going to get injured.
That's right.
But from where I was, it was just unbelievable. When the buses actually passed, it was a bit of a letdown. It was just a gang of lads in place, waving and looking drunk.
You do expect something supernatural to happen, don't
just
you?
Just a little bit. The wheels were actually on the tarmac, and they were going very slowly. But I had this notion that it was like two very colourful, very packed coffins being carried down O'Connell Street.
I mean, it was really pride, wasn't it? And
it was brilliant.
The lads represent diaspora. Do you think we've never really had a moment since then like that?
Do you know, it might sound a bit weird, but I think, yeah, in terms of cause for celebration, yeah, possibly we haven't had a moment like it since. Mm. I can't think of any. And it was a moment that seemed to linger, actually. I do think there's a certain truth in that we were never quite the same again. I think, you know, it's hard to quantify. It's hard. There's no statistic will ever prove it or disprove it, but it just felt that way. But in a certain way, I think this might sound daft, but I felt that around about March of this year, where there was a level of unity, March and April, a level of unity and a level of we're in this together.
Yeah.
A sense of that here, which seemed to be absent in other places where they speak the English language.
Yes, yeah.
And I felt it was in a quiet way, a little bit similar. Do you know?
Yeah.
That might be daft, but that was my feeling at the time.
I suppose there was the quiet authority of what had been an unpopular government. And
yes,
there was a sense of that we should all just be sound about it.
Yes. Yeah.
And you don't get that anywhere else, do you?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Where they speak the English language. Nostalgia sometimes, it gives you that warm, fuzzy feeling. And if we miss because of the thing, in June particularly, the 30-year anniversary of Italia 90. But Big Jack's passing kind of put it into focus again. Are we in danger of looking back a little bit too rosily at that era? Because 1990 was a fairly grim time in Ireland.
It was, but I think it's also important not to exaggerate it, really.
Yeah.
You know, I was teaching in Kilbarrick and Greendale Community School, and statistically, yeah, you could see the unemployment rate was really high, and a lot of the people I was teaching were emigrating and going away. But at the same time, there was an extraordinary energy and a level of wit and great, great spirit. And you know, when things began to pick up, it didn't surprise me all that much. It was as if there was potential lurking there all along. So, yes, it was grim in some ways, but there was a lot of great stuff happening at the same time, you know. And I think, in a way, the World Cup encapsulated that somehow. But I do agree with you about nostalgia. But the thing is that looking back at the past isn't just nostalgic.
You mean it's lessons to be learned?
I think so, in a way, yeah. And it's like the similarities. You know, when you're reading these, I've read several books about the plagues, you know, the various plagues. Most recently, Emma Donoghue's one, Pull of the Stars. And it's all so familiar, you know.
Yeah.
The messages that are being conveyed to people, you know, people washing their hands or not washing their hands, coughing at each other, not coughing at each other. Saying there's nothing going on, and there's other people saying it's the end of the world. It's all so familiar. It's actually quite reassuring. You know, we've always been Egypts.
We don't change. A text is coming in, 51551. Kevin Sheedy's family came from Dara, Ballyee in County Clare. He was born in Bulleth Wells in Wales.
Yes.
Bulleth Wells, yeah, that's news to me as well.
Doesn't ring off. I bet you never went through there.
No, definitely not. The van. Have you seen the film in recent years?
No, I haven't seen it since it was released.
That's something you do generally, isn't it? You haven't seen The Commitments either? Or...
No, I don't. I don't go back and look at the stuff, no.
So no nostalgia for you there in that area?
No, maybe eventually. I just feel I feel a bit uncomfortable looking at stuff.
Yeah,
that
sure,
I've done,
that's,
you know?
That's the way you look at it. But there are kind of echoes of it, particularly this kind of the sense of self-worth, the men as the breadwinner, and just the work, I suppose. And it's 1990, and now we're 30 years on. Has things changed for people? You don't want to separate people, but of people of that class?
People
of that class. I mean, you, Rosie went out on St. Patrick's Night.
Yes.
About the homeless crisis, and it's again that sense of, you know, people want to obviously just be independent.
Yeah, people want. Well, yes, I think, you know, in some ways it's quite distressing because in many ways things haven't changed. I think they have, and in some ways I suspect, I'm not really qualified to talk about younger people, but I suspect that they're less defined by what they do. Now, that could be a class thing, you know, but I don't think they're as defined as what they do. And I think one of the first questions you would have been asked years ago is, what do you do? You know, yeah. And it stopped being a question during the recession because it was just an awkward question sometimes, if you remember, about 10 years ago. But I think... you know, for example, when I struck off to be independent, to be, you know, as a young man, to be independent, I found a place to live. I went out one evening and found a place to live that evening, a bedsit.
Yeah.
And it was a small chunk of my salary, and I could well afford it and get the hang of living independently by just being in one room and sharing the jacks and the rest of it. Yeah. And it was great, brilliant. And that category of housing disappeared because it was considered unsuitable. And it is, in a sense, part of the reason why so many people are homeless, because there's a whole layer, not ideal by any means, but it was looked at by middle-class people, probably middle-aged, and they were appalled. Whereas if you're a working-class or a middle-class kid of 21, 22, 23, up to 30 maybe, it's grand.
It was freedom.
You know? Absolute, yeah, it was freedom. So you could afford to strike out on your own if you had any sort of a job. And sometimes if you didn't have a job at all. But that's gone now. And I think it's very, very difficult for younger people, particularly working class kids, but also middle class kids to a large degree, to just strike out on their own and to be able to look around them at some stage in their lives and say, this is me, as opposed to waiting for, you know, a few quid to come in from the parents into the bank account or things like that, you know. So it's difficult.
The powerful message from Rosie, I think, for a lot of people was the fact that the homeless crisis affected working people, working families. Because there's been creeping suspicion from people in politics. They've been casting suspicions, as they're overly suspicious maybe of people on welfare and people on the housing list and so on.
Yeah.
Are you surprised now that, given the scale of the crisis we're through now, and we all promised we were going to live our lives differently and see the world differently, the housing crisis is kind of well down the pecking order at the minute, as though it's been
at
solved.
At the moment, yeah. And actually, when you think about it, somebody mentioned Brexit on the radio a few days ago. An almighty joke. I thought it had gone away. So, yeah, the housing crisis, which was top of the agenda brilliantly at the last election, has disappeared back down the agenda. But I suppose, who's to know what will happen, you know, in the meantime? But I noticed that, you know, even the PUP, the PUP payment, suddenly, you know, earlier in the week, we were being told that basically it's the dole and you have to go and get a job.
Yeah.
You know, so the attitude has shifted somehow since March. And it's as if, yeah, anybody who is in receipt of money from the state is something of a sponger, you know. And I thought maybe, you know, I suppose naively, I thought maybe with the end of the difference, or the temporary end of the difference between public health and private health and things like this, that we'd, you know, rethink how we do these things. But, and maybe we still will, but it's dispiriting, really, when you hear that.
The Italian 90 feeling of March, April feels 30 years ago as well, isn't it?
At the moment it does, yeah. But it's... I mean, I went to see as the exhibition there on Wednesday morning. And I got the bus into town for the first time, and it was grand. It was nice looking out the window for the first time since March. I strolled through town early morning. It seemed a bit desolate, but later on it was filling up and it was a bit like town. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I went to the exhibition and it really was great. It was great to be at something again, you know.
Yeah.
I hadn't been to anything since March, and it was really, really nice just to be in the room and looking at this stuff. It's really good. Visually, it's terrific. It's great fun as well. And all sorts of, I'd forgotten about the T-shirts. Do you remember the T-shirts?
I vaguely remember. I would have been, you know, I definitely had a Give It a Lash Jack T-shirt or Jack the Lad T-shirt.
There'd be T-shirts on the streets within hours and sometimes even sooner of a match being over, you know. It was amazing. They were wet. People were putting kind of...
The ink is
possibly dangerous. Probably their skin was burning on them. Yeah.
And it wouldn't last one wash in the washing machine. They would just be gone.
That was it. Yeah, it was a tea towel. Yeah, with sleeves.
Do you must be missing pubs.
Do you know? Yeah, in a way, I'm missing my friends. Mm-hmm. I really haven't gone into a pub since the, you know, the idea that you have to have what do they call it, a substantial meal,
yeah.
Which must cost £9. I'd love to be in the room where they're coming up with this. Yeah. I can see why they want to be careful or whatever, but I'm happy enough to waste till. You know, I'm not happy. You know, I'm not obviously not going to wait till everything is back to normal, because there's a possibility that will never be the case, you know. Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to wait till you can just walk into a pub and have a drink, and even if you can't stay too long. But I tell you, I meet friends on Zoom. We uh-huh. normally meet on a Thursday night, and we've been meeting, not last night, but we've been meeting most Thursdays. And one of the great things about a pub is the ambient noise, because when you're with a couple of friends on Zoom and nobody's talking, it's excruciating.
It fills in the gap.
It's absolutely, yeah. So the telly in the corner, it may be annoying at times, but I tell you, it does serve a function.
Yeah. Those dramatic moments of silence between men in pubs. Maybe that's what's missing. But you're keeping in touch with friends anyway through the Zoom.
Trying to, yeah.
Is it a poor substitute for the pub, though?
Oh, Jesus, yeah, no, it's as with most things. Like, Zoom meetings, work meetings are actually, I don't have all that many, but, you know, they're not too bad. I mean, particularly when you're at a certain stage in a piece of work, say a production of some sort, there's no need, you say, for example, to go to London or go to, you know, across the city or whatever. A short meeting on Zoom will do the trick. So I'm sold in some ways, but no, it's more or less... I've heard people saying that the future of third level education is going to be online. And you know what? They're missing the point. You don't go to college to learn. You go to college to mingle, to meet people, to socialise.
It's a rite of passage, isn't it? For adulthood.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I'd miss more than anything else, yeah. Because I work alone all day as well, you know, so...
Yeah. And you work every day?
I work Monday to Friday.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you put in the hours as a writer, as though it's a regular gig.
I do. Yeah, it's I've always treated it as a job, and I have little targets to reach, you know, each day, and I kind of self-imposed deadlines. And during the pandemic or the lockdown, and that I always tried to send off some sort of piece of work at the end of the week, you know, work in progress or something, just to say that, well, I did that this week, you know.
Yeah.
But it's part of the, you know, when you work alone, you have to have these little tricks.
And your latest novel, Love, was out. What can we look forward to hearing or seeing from you next?
I'm writing short stories at the moment. Uh-huh. I thought it was the best way for me personally to try and capture the moments. I was writing a novel and it's set in the present day, but I realised, you know, in early March, I didn't know what the present day meant. You know, it was a different experience every time you turned on the radio.
Time disappeared.
So I decided I'd write short stories. So I just finished the third one there, sent it off to my agent yesterday.
Very good. And so it's lockdown-based, is it?
Yeah, this one I finished is just, it's narrated by two people, and one of them is a woman, and she availed of the lockdown to disappear.
Right. So she kind of took the advantages of it.
She just, she thought, well, in sometimes she worked out the logic later, but she just walked out the door. And it was the perfect timing.
Will that be out next year, do you think?
I hope so, yeah. Yeah, I hope so. I think I've the makings of a collection in my head, but I have to write them, obviously. But I've finished three, and I'd like to do about 10.
Right.
You know, 10 seems like a good number for a book, doesn't it?
We look forward to that.
But, yeah, well, Love is out in October. It was supposed to come out in March.
It was supposed to come out, okay.
It was supposed to come out in May, and they rightly postponed it. It was disappointing at the time, but it was the right decision. Yeah. So it's out in October.
That's out in October. Great. And the Italian 90 exhibition is open.
It opens today, I think.
It's open today.
Yeah,
it's open tomorrow,
it's really
actually.
Good.
Tomorrow is the opening of the Little Museum.
Oh, is it? Right.
And all the memories will come flooding back for people.
Yeah, and a lot more. I mean, I was so much that I'd forgotten. And, you know, a good recall. But visually, the little things I'd forgotten. Haircuts. You tend to forget. And because footballers at the time more or less had the same haircut, really. They didn't, you know, they weren't, it wasn't the Paul Pogba generation. So they all really had the same haircut. But those of us who didn't play football, the haircuts are really, so the haircuts and the tracksuits.
That's a very specific memory there. Remember the big, the baggy tracksuits, shell tracksuits.
Yeah.
The texts are coming in, Roddy. Somebody says, for me, the best line from the van was the kid looking for a Dunphy and chips.
All right.
This is Mike and Roscommon. 1990 was a great sporting year. Italia 90 and Cork winning the double. Never to be seen again.
And that's suddenly something that didn't register with me at all.
Not at all. Jim is in the rainy, real capital there. Roddy sums it up so well. I'm half Irish, an English northerner, but a real Paddy at heart. Jack brought the Irishness early on and authentically loved managing them. The chemistry just worked. Yeah, the chemistry was there, wasn't it?
It was indeed,
They
yeah.
saw him as their dad, I think.
Yeah, and it was lovely things. I don't know, did you see the boys in green? Where Jack, even there was a ball boy or something, that Jack went out of his way to go and have a chat with him because he used to go fishing.
Right, okay.
You know, can you imagine Jose Mourinho doing that?
Well, Jack Charlton used to come up to the Newmarle Hotel in Monaghan. We would all be trying to catch a sneak of the team for training, but it was just because he wanted to go fishing there. Completely agree with Roddy about bedsits. As a student in the late 60s, I shared a bedsit with a friend, shared bathroom, but otherwise it was beautifully appointed, very comfortable, says John in Lucan.
He must be an estate agent now. He's called the lingo.
Susan says, disappearance of the bedsits sounded the death knell for housing and we can still hear it. Bring the bedsits back. Well, actually, the bedsits were brought back, but only after they closed them and turned two into one and then brought them back again when it was all a little bit too late. The woman who walked into door some years ago, probably decades ago, Roddy Doyle's book was televised in 6 episodes. It was the most insightful and poignant depiction of Irish life. Love your writing, Roddy.
It was called Family and it was 4 episodes, 1994. Yeah. And Ger Ryan played Paula Spencer.
Ger Ryan. Yeah, she was always a feature in adaptations, wasn't she, on the telly?
Oh, yeah, she was absolutely brilliant. But unusually enough, the television series came first and then I wrote the novel.
On Family, by the way, when you look back now and particularly the way the world has turned, you know, you're a man writing about domestic violence on women. How do you think that would be received now?
Oh, it's an interesting question, really, because I doubt if there'd be... Well, definitely there wouldn't be remotely the same fuss. I mean, I got death threats because of that when it came out and all sorts of vile messages. Luckily, there was no social media, so it wasn't like that, but... I don't think there'd be half the fuss. I was the subject of sermons in churches.
Yeah.
I was debated in the Dáil. I was on Questions and Answers. When you live a quiet life, it's an amazing and unsettling experience. But I don't think there'd be half the fuss. And I don't think there'd be all that many people denying that domestic violence exists behind closed doors in Ireland.
Yeah. They pretended, wasn't it? I'll give you one last text before we let you go. Hi, I'm a past pupil of Mr. Doyle. He was magic. We all loved Punk Doyle. You had the best teacher's nickname of all time. You were lucky. Listen, a real pleasure talking to you, Roddy.
And you, Oliver.
Take care of yourself. Look after yourself and yours. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Italian
Bye-bye.
90. Rev it up and here we go.